On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Curtis Franklin and Mr. Brian G. back on the show. Now, industrial control systems are here to stay. Some organizations haven't upgraded the hardware or even the passwords for decades. We're going to talk about some of the threats there and what organizations can do to make it better. Plus, we've had this guest on before to talk about full observability, full stack observability. But with hybrid work, there's some new skills and some new ways to manage those things coming to the forefront. Today, we have Greg Ostrowski back on the show, executive CTO of Cisco AppDynamics. And we're talking about some of the emerging techniques and trends out there and what organizations can do about it. You definitely shouldn't miss it. Twyatt on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 503, recorded July 22nd, 2022. Dashboard fatigue. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Thinks Canary. Detect attackers on your network while avoiding irritating false alarms. Get the alerts that matter. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit and enter the code TWIT in the How to Hear About Us box. And by Cisco Meraki. With employees working in different locations, providing a unified work experience seems as easy as herding cats. How do you rein in so many moving parts? The Meraki Cloud Managed Network. Learn how your organization can make hybrid work work. Visit meraki.cisco.com/twit. And by userway.org. Userway is the world's number one accessibility solution. It's committed to enabling the fundamental human right of digital accessibility for everyone. When you're ready to make your site compliant, deciding which solution to use is an easy choice to make. Go to userway.org/twit for 30% off Userway's AI-powered accessibility solution. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world's connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big world of the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their fields, starting with our very own Mr. Brian Chi. He's net architect at SkyFiber and pretty much all-around tech geek. Chibert, how are you, my friend? You got those 3D printers set up yet?
No, I need to clean up. Mostly, I've got to go and crawl into the attic of my garage, make sure there's nothing in the way, and put an exhaust fan in. All that stuff's finally arrived, so maybe if it cools down just a bit, I might crawl up there, sweat buckets, and start installing it. But hey, I can always go down to the makerspace and use those 3D printers, so we'll see what I can do.
There you go. Fantastic. It's great to have you here. Well, speaking of experts, we also have our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's senior analyst at Omdia, and he's our security enterprise expert. Curtis, you have some big shows coming up pretty soon, right?
I do have a little bit of travel coming up. As a matter of fact, next week I'm going to be up in Beantown at the AWS Reinforce event happening in Boston. So if anybody's going to be there, let me know. Would love to see you. Get to be home for a week and then back out again, this time to Las Vegas and to Black Hat and DEF CON. So a lot of travel coming up. Have a couple of virtual things happening that I'll mention in more detail at the end of the show. And lots of writing, some video commentary, you name it, I'm doing it. I'm just an opinion-slinging fool over here at Omdia.
Thanks, Curtis, for being here. Well, speaking of opinionated and commentary, we have lots to talk about on this show today. Now, industrial control systems are here to stay. Some organizations have hardware that they haven't touched in almost a decade. And that includes the password for the device as well. So we're going to talk about the threats that are here and just what organizations can actually do about it. Plus, we've had this guest on before about full stack observability. But with hybrid work, it's forced a new way of thinking for applications and even their architecture that's out there, and the skills that the organizations need to manage things. Today we have to welcome back Greg Ostrowski. He's executive CTO at Cisco AppDynamics. And we're going to talk about some of the emerging trends that are out there and what organizations need to do about it. But you know, before we get to all that fun stuff, we do have to go ahead and jump into this week's news blips. And we've been talking about SolarWinds and supply chain attacks for a while now. It's started as an industry movement as well to ensure that things are more secure, including open source. However, the hacker group behind the infamous SolarWinds espionage campaign has evolved to using things like Google Drive to deliver their malware. And according to this TechCrunch article, Palo Alto's Unit 42 threat intelligence team put out a statement this week that the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service, SVR, which is tracked as Cloaked Ursa, or also known as APT-29 or Cozy Bear, has incorporated Google's cloud storage service into its hacking campaigns. Now, they are hiding their malware and their activities on the Google Drive. Their target, well, it's so far been in diplomatic missions and foreign embassies in Portugal and Brazil from this past May. Now, this is a change in tactics to try and use common trusted services like these in order to initiate attacks. Now, in addition to Google Drive, they've also incorporated the use of Dropbox in their command and control infrastructure. And what I suggest here is these types of storage locations should be secured with things like, I don't know, Windows Information Protection or Defender Advanced Threat Protection, or ATP, any kind of threat protection. And that will ensure that, you know, things cannot go awry there. But what I can see is maybe some additional organizations out there also pushing down policies to lock down the usage of cloud storage like this, even more so than before. Some might even disable third-party storage providers going forward. Thanks, Cozy Bear, for ruining the convenience once again.
Well, just to keep things nice and cloudy, there's new cloud-enabled macOS spyware on the scene. Now, cloud computing is old news for the enterprise. For criminals, though, it seems that it may be just getting started. There's new macOS spyware being used in a highly targeted campaign that steals documents, keystrokes, screen captures, and more from Apple computers. Cloud Mensis uses public cloud storage services for housing payloads and for their C2 communications. This highly unusual architecture makes the normal malware forensic process very difficult and, well, very different. ESET analyzed the malware and this week reported that after initial compromise, the cyber attackers used known vulnerabilities to gain code execution and privilege escalation capabilities. In an article published at my sister publication, Dark Reading, they report that the actual spyware payload then comes from a cloud storage provider like pCloud, Dropbox, or Yandex. According to the ESET researchers, Cloud Mensis supports 39 different commands, including commands to download a wide variety of data types, as well as a directive to download additional malware. Now, all of this stolen data is encrypted using a public key found in the download agent, though it requires a private key, which, by coincidence, is owned by the Cloud Mensis operators for decryption. What we don't know so far is precisely who is behind Cloud Mensis. Its overall behavior suggests an APT group, like those associated with many nation states, but researchers say there aren't enough clues in the malware code to point definitively to a specific group. In addition, speaking of that code, researchers point out that it's not terribly sophisticated, not the professional, high-quality malware code most APT developers pride themselves on creating. Now, want to keep Cloud Mensis out of your Mac? Patch and update religiously. Current generation code coupled with strong passwords and good authentication practice should keep Cloud Mensis something to read about rather than something to experience.
This PC Mag article, thank you, Oliver, and his fellow PC Maggers. Anyway, the FBI is trying to reach out to the tech community and saying, if you're hit by ransomware, don't forget to call us. So in a previous report, federal investigators recovered $500,000 in ransom payments after a Kansas medical provider called the FBI about the incident, according to U.S. Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco. The Justice Department is reminding ransomware victims to report attacks to authorities by pointing out there's a chance the agency can recover ransom funds. Well, a case in point, on last Tuesday, U.S. Deputy Attorney Lisa Monaco announced that federal investigators recovered about $500,000 in ransom payments thanks to a Kansas City medical provider calling the FBI about that incident. If you report an attack, If you report the ransom demand and payment, if you work with the FBI, they can take action, according to Monaco. Well, I'd like to add my two cents to the conversation and encourage organizations to get proactive about a relationship with the FBI and consider joining InfraGuard. Now, it is a nonprofit. It is associated with the FBI, and the FBI helps move it along, but it is run by the membership. So what it does do is it gives you a chance to go and get a little bit behind the scenes. They do a light background check to make sure you're not a terrorist or someone like that. But it does give you access to information and bulletins that would normally be restricted to government employees only. So the bottom line is, who are you going to call? And that's the FBI.
It wouldn't be a week of the enterprise and IT news without reporting a zero day for you, don't you think? Now, this one's targeting Google Chrome. The origin, according to this TechCrunch article, an Israeli spyware maker who's been targeting journalists in the Middle East. Now, cybersecurity company Avast has linked the exploitation to Kandiru, or a Tel Aviv-based hacking for hire company, also known as Sato Tech, which provides this powerful spyware to government clients. The way they've been able to spread the malware, well, they did that by compromising a website used by the employees of the different news agencies, possibly to spy on them, but also possibly to try to obtain their sources of their news stories. The exploit was designed to collect about 50 data points from the victim's browser, including language, time zone, screen information, device type, browser plugins, and device memory, likely to ensure that only devices of those who are specifically targeted were ultimately compromised. And when a target is found, the Chrome Zero Day creates a foothold on the victim's machine to deliver the spyware payload, which researchers have dubbed Devil's Tongue. A Devil's Tongue, like other government-grade spyware, can steal the contents of the victim's phone, including messages, photos, and call logs, and track a victim's location in real time. Scary. Luckily, Google has already put an update out there. That also means you better make sure you force the update and restart that browser before the weekend. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we do have to thank a fabulous sponsor of this week at Enterprise Tech, and that's Thanks Canary. Now, if there's anything we've learned from this last year is that companies make it a priority to layer the security of their networks. And one of these layers needs to be Thanks Canary. Unfortunately, companies usually find out too late that they've been compromised, even after they've already spent millions on IT security. Now, attackers are sneaky. Unbeknownst to companies, they prowl networks looking for the valuable data. But the great thing about Canary is that they've turned this into an advantage for you. While attackers browse Active Directory for file servers and explore file shares, they'll be looking for documents. They'll scan for open services across the network. Now, Thanks Canaries are designed to look like the things hackers want to get to. Canaries can be deployed throughout your entire network, and you can make them look identical. So a router, a switch, a NAS server, a Linux box, or even a Windows server. So attackers won't know they've been caught. Now you can put fake files on them and name them in any way that you want to get their hackers' attention. And you can enroll them into Active Directory right away. And when attackers investigate further, they give themselves away and you're instantly notified. Now, Canary tokens act as tiny tripwires that you can drop into hundreds of places. Now, Canary is designed to be installed and configured in minutes. And you won't have to think about it again. Now, if alert happens, Canary will notify you in the way that you want, and you won't be inundated with all those false alarms out there. Now, get alerts by email or text message, right on their console, through Slack, webhooks, syslog, or even just their API. Now, data breaches happen typically through your staff, and when they do, companies often don't know they've been compromised. It takes an average of 191 days for a company to realize there's been a data breach. Canary solves that problem. A Canary was created by people who have trained companies, militaries, governments on how to break into networks. And with that knowledge, they've built Canary. Now, you'll find Canaries deployed all over the world and are one of the best tools against data breaches. Visit canary.tools/twit. And for just $7,500 per year, you get 5 Canaries, your own hosted console, upgrade support, and maintenance. And if you use the code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box, you'll get 10% off the price for life. We know you'll love your Thanks Canary, but if you're not happy, you can always return the Canaries with their 2-month money-back guarantee for a full refund. That's canary.tools/twit and enter the code TWIT in the How to Hear Us box. And we thank Things Canary for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, we've talked about industrial systems in the past. They can range from, you know, new systems all the way down to, you know, decades old systems out there. Some manufacturing facilities haven't even changed their lines for decades, and they are actually seeing an increased focus from hackers to start getting industrial systems with malware. Now, from what we've seen so far, if a hacker can crack a password, they can deploy a botnet anywhere on the network. Now, cracking passwords on an older industrial controlled hardware like a PLC can actually be easy for some of those modern techniques out there. Now, I remember being on a beer line once before trying to access PLCs with my ladder logic, and all I needed was an IP and a password to deploy the code. Now, I can take a gander and say that that's probably true for a lot of organizations out there even today. Now, here's an example of a botnet hack. Dragos, which helps firms secure industrial control systems against ransomware, state-sponsored hackers, and potential saboteurs, recently performed a routine vulnerability assessment and found that software advertised as a password cracker from the Direct Logic 06 or a PLC sold by Automation Direct. The software recovered the password, but not through the normal method of cracking a cryptography or cryptographic hash. Instead, the software exploited a zero-day vulnerability in the Automatic Direct PLCs that exposed the passcode. Now, besides recovering the password, it also revealed that there was also malware installed called Solidity. It made the infected system part of a botnet and monitored the clipboard of the infection workstation every half second for any data related to cryptocurrency wallet addresses. And these examples just call out that there needs to be additional focus on industrial control systems. The question is, what are organizations supposed to do here, especially ones that have used their same systems for over a decade? Curtis, I'm going to bring you in first because this is a security problem, obviously, but it also means that there needs to be a change in the way some of these organizations think. I can just think of probably 100 different manufacturing, from food to all the way down to building a bike, that might have these systems on their lines or even in their factories that are open to exploit. What can organizations do to secure themselves?
Well, I think the answer to that comes in the answer to the question, how long have your systems been in place and who made them? Because let's admit, if you've got PLCs from a company like Siemens on your line, then it is likely that there are updates that can happen from the manufacturer. Siemens is still in business, still a good engineering firm. They can do things. If, on the other hand, you have some high-end control or even low-end control that's been in place for 15 years and you can no longer read who made it because the box that the controller sits in has been whacked into by a forklift so many times, then it may be that you can't do anything but do what I call Band-Aid security. Band-Aid security is where you lay something over the top of it. You end up having to put gateway security on, some infrastructures, network-based security, knowing that you have vulnerable devices on the inside. So this is one of those cases, while we talk about defense in depth and we talk about modern zero trust and all that, there are situations, this one, where you have to just try to make your perimeter as impenetrable as possible, knowing that if an attacker gets in, they can run lightly through fields of data on your industrial controllers.
Right. Now, you brought up a good point. Obviously, these things could be 10, 15 years old, and they're not going to be upgraded. They're not going to be changed, probably. The question is, should they be maybe monitoring their network for more of this traffic rather than trying to go and update the device themselves? Should they be taking inventory of these devices and making sure passwords are changed? Cheever, what do you think? What do you think is the, because you have a lot of experience with PLCs.
Well, here's one of the things that kind of chaps me, fill in the blanks, is the vast majority of the PLCs that I've worked with can't be monitored short of pings. And you can't ping too often because some of these PLCs, their stacks are so fragile that if you do six pings in a row, it tips over. But that isn't the biggest problem. I'm going to be the doom and gloom here. Ars Technica did a really nice job on this article when they're talking about a lot of different things, especially password crackers. But here's the problem. I've worked in some really, really old industrial infrastructures trying to help them modernize. And a lot of PLCs don't even have passwords. In fact, they have no way of doing any kind of passwords, or if they do have passwords, it's clear text. No excuse. You know, if you're converting over to a PLC infrastructure that is running on any kind of network, and trust me, Modbus, aka RS-485, is a network. It's a serial network, and it can only go up to, you know, maybe 225 kilobits per second, but it's still a network. I can easily demonstrate how I can clip onto an RS-485 network and peel off passwords being used to talk to PLCs. It's not hard. So this is something I'm shouting out to people like the American Bureau of Shipping. I was working on a ship. We were trying desperately to upgrade the PLCs that are controlling things like rudder movement or how fast is the engine turning or air conditioning or the generators. You know, all kinds of PLCs are everywhere on a ship. I wanted to go and change it from coax Ethernet, which was running right next to high voltage lines, to fiber optics, which didn't care as much. It took me a year of fighting the bureaucratic paperwork to get permission to change something that simple. I didn't even ask to change the PLCs. I just wanted to change the communication method so that interference on the coax Ethernet line wouldn't keep PLCs crashing. You know, having a PLC crash for, say, like rudder control while you're on the high seas or trying to dock is a big bummer. Well, here's the other thing that I want to send out to people that manage infrastructure on any kind of buildings or whatever. Your contractor put in probably a set of default passwords. Maybe they got smart and went beyond standard default and changed it to something that you couldn't look up on the internet. On things like smart meters or controls, so like being an automatic transfer switch to force a flip between, say, a diesel generator and the grid. Those are all controlled by PLCs now. So when a contractor says, here's a set of passwords, and here's where in the manual you're supposed to change the passwords, for goodness sakes, change the passwords. And, oh, by the way, infrastructure engineers, you don't have to have the same password on every PLC. The control software has the ability to have different passwords, different usernames, different levels of users on every single control channel. This is not hard. You need to do a little bit of investment so that your air conditioning engineers, your power engineers, and people like that get a little bit more up to date on how networks work, because too many of these industrial engineers just say, well, I just won't let anyone touch the network. It's like, excuse me, you have boxes out on your manufacturing floor that are only opened with a screwdriver or with a wrench that has a network switch in there. Plugging a laptop in there with Sniffer or Wireshark or something like that will allow any competent hacker, even someone just getting started, can sniff passwords and in minutes be able to go and change the programming of your PLCs. It's not that hard. So, industrial engineers, you guys need to go and work with your IT group. Don't just start giving them lip service that, oh yeah, we're making it so that no one can access it. Yeah, well, I'm sorry. unless you're going to have someone physically guarding every single PLC and every single switch and every single access to your industrial control network, you might start thinking about being a little more realistic about passwords and about your PLCs. They're not that expensive. They are a pain to change. Yes, they are. But going to one of the newer types of PLCs that actually can have encrypted communications would be most excellent.
Well, you know, password changing passwords are hard, Brian, right?
Oh, yeah.
No, I've heard some scary things like Stuxnet malware tweaked PLCs to actually manipulate centrifuge units of nuclear power plants. Scary stuff here. Now, the question I want to throw this to Curtis. Curtis, you know, if you have to keep these types of tools, these types of systems in place, especially in your old facilities, there's got to be some industry tools to help, right?
It kind of depends, you know, and, you know, let's look at Stuxnet. Now, Stuxnet was a nation state developed piece of malware. It attacked a particular PLC, a Siemens PLC, one that was used for the gas centrifuges that Iran was using to enrich uranium. And basically, it ran them out of control. Even gas centrifuges that run at incredibly high RPM have their limits. And if you go past that, you end up destroying them. So what do you do? And the answer is that the first thing you have to do is admit that someone might want to get into your PLCs and that the possibility exists for them to do just that. The idea that somehow we're going to keep them separate, that we're going to make sure that no one can get to them in any way, that's great if you can actually pull it off. Brian mentioned some of the issues that you have. And trust me, for most organizations, especially those that use older PLCs, having an armed guard standing beside their production lines 24 hours a day just isn't a real option. So what do? They have to, as I said, admit that there's the possibility of an issue. Go and harden the perimeter as much as possible. Recognize if there are issues, especially if they are going and sniffing their data to send over to the IT. What we're seeing is that OT, operational technology, the controllers we're talking about, and IT are coming together more and more often because companies want to be able to have the data from their production lines to throw into their enterprise resource planning. So once you have that data flow, if you've got a connection, you've got a potential vulnerability. And it's not that hard to find. Well-constructed Shodan searches will tell you an awful lot. And so admit that there's the possibility of a problem. Hit it at the perimeter if you must. Work with the vendor to harden the individual PLCs if you can. And continually monitor what kind of network traffic is going on so that if you see something unusual going out to a location that is unusual, you at least have some warning that things are not as they should be within your operational technology, and you can start immediately on remediation.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, perimeter detection can help in many cases, obviously, especially these types of systems. Chibert, you know, Curtis brought up a good point about IoT devices. A lot of organizations are using these more. They're using smaller, cheaper devices here, like Arduinos, Raspberry Pis, that kind of thing, in their settings. Is this better, worse? What can people do here?
It's neither better nor worse. It's different. One of the things I really, really, really love about general purpose industrial control computers like the Raspberry Pi, Arduino, and so forth, is that they are general purpose. I'm able to use, as long as you pay attention and you have one that's hardened, so that at least you've turned off the ports that you aren't using, use, a secure Linux kernel. You can do a lot of really cool things. And the best part is instead of having to use proprietary industrial control monitoring systems that cost a king's ransom, I can use less expensive systems. Like, for instance, when I had to do one industrial control application, I actually used the product from Tim Titus. We've had him on the show several times. It's called Path Solutions Total View. Because there were so many devices that couldn't talk SNMP in the industrial control world, what I did was I did a half step. I upgraded all the switches to more modern switches that could talk SNMP V3. And then we had Total Solutions monitoring the paths between all the switches and the devices. They couldn't monitor the device directly, but we could at least see if there was a dramatic increase in the pattern of data transmission to and from those devices, so that we're able to go and see if something has changed. Because that's one of the big issues on trying to find someone hacking you. You look for the deltas. And so by combining general purpose IoT devices, I can put those into key locations so I can monitor the health of quadrants or areas within an industrial control application, even if I can't monitor the PLCs directly.
All great suggestions. I'm hoping at least some decision makers are listening. If not, hopefully you at home can convince your decision makers they need to make some changes here. Well, folks, that does it for the Bytes. Next up, we have a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. But before we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Cisco Meraki, the experts in cloud-based networking for hybrid work. Whether your employees are working at home, at a cabin in the mountains, and I wish I could be there, or on a lounge chair at a beach there as well, a cloud-managed network provides the same exceptional work experience no matter where they are. They may as well roll out the welcome mat because hybrid work is here to stay. Hybrid work works best in the cloud and has perks for both employees and leaders as well. When workers can move faster and deliver better results with cloud-managed network, while leaders can automate distributed operations, build more sustainable workspaces, and proactively protect the network. Now, an IDG Market Pulse research report conducted for Meraki highlights top tier opportunities in supporting hybrid work. Now, hybrid work is a priority for 78% of C-suite executive leaders who want to drive collaboration forward while staying on top of or boosting productivity and security. Now, hybrid work also has its challenges. The IDG report raises the red flag about security, noting that 48% of leaders report cybersecurity threats as a primary obstacle to improving workforce experiences. Always on security monitoring is part of what makes the cloud managed network so awesome. Now, IT can use apps from Meraki's vast ecosystem of partners, turnkey solutions built to work seamlessly with the Meraki cloud platform for asset tracking, location analytics, and more. To gather insights on how people use their workspaces in a smart space, environmental sensors can track activity and occupancy levels to stay on top of cleanliness. Reserve workspaces based on a vacancy and employee profiles, also called hot desking, allows employees to scout out a spot in a snap. Locations in restricted environments can be booked in advance and include time-based door access. Now, mobile device management is also there. Integrating devices and systems allow IT to manage, update, and troubleshoot company-owned devices, even when the device and employees are in a remote location. Turn any space into a place of productivity and empower your organization with the same exceptional experience no matter where they work with Meraki and the Cisco suite of technology. Learn how your organization can make hybrid work work. Visit meraki.cisco.com/twit. And we thank Cisco Meraki for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on you. And today we have the pleasure of welcoming back to the show the executive CTO of Cisco AppDynamics, a different division of Cisco, Mr. Greg. Yes, I know. I had to say that before we introduced you because they are very different in many cases. Mr. Greg Ostrowski, welcome back, Greg, to the show. We appreciate you being here.
Yeah, thank you, Lou. Thanks for having me on again. It's great to jump in and chat with you guys.
Absolutely. We have lots to talk about. Now, we've had you on before. We talked about full stack observability. I think there was always a lot more to talk about there. So we wanted to have you back and talk about more. But sure. One of the interesting thing here, there's a huge visibility thing that's going on. Obviously, the pandemic is out there. We know about the pandemic. But, you know, we're seeing that there's a market shift in what organizations need to do to stay ahead of the curve. Now, AppDynamics recently put out some research there called the Agents of Transformation Report. It's an interesting report, but can you maybe tell us what the purpose of the report is and what's going on there?
Yeah, for sure. So we've been doing this for now about 4 years, and it's a report called Agents of Transformation. And what we do is we commission a third party to go out and survey approximately a little over 1,100 IT professionals from CIO all the way down to the individual contributors. And what we want to do is we want to find out what are some of the challenges they are seeing, what are how they're starting to modify and starting to adapt to the changes that are starting to happen in the industry, but also more so to try to uncover who is what we like to call an agent of transformation. So these are folks who have the right mentality, the right skill set, the right support with inside their organization to really help effectively drive change within their company.
Now, there were some surprising things in this report. Some things we kind of talked about before, but there have been some surprising things. Now, we've talked a lot about the fact that the pandemic has forced digital transformation out there, and that the complexity of systems have gone up, requiring new skill sets. But that also means that some of the current roles that are out there that are already focusing on some of these older or sort of new skill sets need to be moved more towards front and center. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So, you know, the interesting thing is through the report, things that I found really interesting is that 88% felt that the last 4 years changed what it means to be a technologist. And if you kind of think about that, what that really means underneath, you know, you have to have upskill yourself, understand how to move from that traditional mindset to the modernized application approach, but also being able to move from that elements of being reactive and firefighting and getting into ways where you can start to drive innovation and drive the business outcomes you're looking for. So, you know, the other part that kind of dovetails off of that I thought was very interesting is 90% of technologists now feel that they are business invaders, or they're driving the business. And when you kind of look at the pandemic, and the pandemic really exposed this dramatically, technology was the only way that some of the consumers were able to interact with many businesses. So, of course, it's natural that technology is becoming so critical to businesses, and technologists are rising up to be more business leaders than they have in the past.
Right. Now, one of the things I'm also seeing, I work with a lot of organizations out there, and they're saying, you know what, listen, we have these new services that we've moved to the cloud, but we've also been developing new services, and they're actually trying to think about, well, how can I make this, you know, easier to maintain, easier to scale, easier to secure, and they're trying to think about new ways to potentially architect them or design them. Is this something, this type of trend you're seeing throughout the industry? Is organizations have to thinking differently here?
Yeah, you know, so the real change is the fact that the end customer, the employee, are all expecting very high results from their applications. So what that means is methods have to change. And what we've seen in the industry is you've moved from that traditional based app tier node model where things are very very stationary, shall you say, or you know, fix it a hardware, fix it a networks. You have servers you run on, what have you. But then as you move to the cloud, the methodology changes. So you have the idea of building a microservice driven app or a modernized application. You want to be rolling out new features on a very repetitive basis, but you got to have that observability component tied to it. And that's where when we talked last time about full stack observability, that's where that really overlays what the work is going on to be able to modernize your applications. The goal around modernizing applications is really focus on the business outcomes, but also being able to ensure that you drive the best possible user experience. So that's why the observability piece really becomes critical, because if you're driving to certain business outcomes and you start to see a drop in service, you got to be able to quickly course correct so that you can get that trajectory going in the right direction. And ultimately, you know, when it comes down to it, you're moving to a more complex scenario, because your, you know, your traditional app to your node model is very linear. It's very simple. When you move to the cloud, now you sprawl things across many different microservices, multi-cloud environments, hybrid on-prem cloud kind of scenarios. When you look at that, when you start sprawling, it starts bringing in more challenges, right? Because now you have a sprawled IT architecture, and we always talk about silos within IT, right? You have a, you have your network team, your infrastructure team, security, DevOps. When you now move the methodologies to the cloud and you're starting to adopt and modernize architecture, you actually expand the number of silos you have. You have more, you have your teams that are hiring cloud ops folks. SREs are becoming more and more critical. Infrastructure teams that just focus on the cloud infrastructure. And your developers are now focusing on building microservices as opposed to traditional-based apps. So you kind of put all that stuff in perspective, and you look at the challenges that the IT professionals have to do to keep up, maintain themselves, but also drive business. You can see where the approaches and the challenges are starting to be exposed. So that's where, you know, when you look full stack observability is about bringing together the silos, get a common way of troubleshooting and isolating where the problems are, but having that business context so you know the impact that you're driving to the business.
Now, you brought up a good point. Obviously, full stack observability helps with this. But, you know, talking about developing, architecting new systems and services is a challenge. I know I do it for my profession. But what I like to do is look for like standards that are out there, standard practices of architecture and design that helps with this, that helps you design first for particular scenarios like this. Are you seeing some, you know, standards that are coming around this that helps for better observability?
From a standardized perspective, what the approach is around open standards of open telemetry, right? That's one of the biggest pieces that I see coming, and that's really emerging as the de facto standard to be able to observe, modernize, or cloud native based applications. And the nice part is that the cloud providers make it very easy for you to instrument that into your CI/CD pipeline. So we at AppDynamics view that as the direction of the future. And we've actually built a new product called AppDynamics Cloud that integrates directly into OpenTelemetry. And it's actually based as an open standard platform at its core. So that's the big one. That's the big one I see around.
And this standard is, you just announced this recently, right? What, it sounds interesting. AppDynamics Cloud sounds interesting. Now we talked a lot of cloud providers. I'm just curious, what does the cloud provide you? Do I hook it up to my existing applications? How does that work?
Yeah. So the interesting thing is when we started to look at the industry and started to build a product that wanted to fix or go after the big needs that we see, the first thing is when you compare what you've done of yesterday to what you're doing tomorrow, they're completely different, right? It's not comparing apples to apples. So when you look at, you know, the app to your node approach, very simple, single server runs, you know, run your application. Moving to the cloud, you now run across multiple clouds, you run across multiple hosts within a single cloud provider, but also having that sprawled architecture where you have infrastructure that's now dependent on the services that you're running and all that kind of good stuff. So when we built this, we had to solve a couple different challenges. So number one is, you know, how do you visualize an application that's in that entity-based model or that entity-based way. And when you move to the cloud, anything becomes an entity. It's a microservice, could be a load balancer, could be containers or what have you. So we created a new method where you can start to see all the dependencies upstream, downstream of the application or the service that you're in focus of. The other part is around keeping that full text, the full stack context. So we created a relationship pane that shows that the business transaction at the very top to the services or applications you're running, then to all the infrastructure that's supporting it. So if you have a Kubernetes infrastructure and you have this expanding and contrasting containerized environment, being able to have visibility into that is absolutely critical. But the interesting piece that we've included is the fact that you want to keep everything in context. So if I'm now running a team of, you know, cloud ops and I have infra ops and DevOps within that, if I'm now troubleshooting issues that are going through one of my Kubernetes environments, going through the pods and containers, I need to have that context of what application is being impacted. And that's really part of the key piece of making sure that anybody who's in that stream or that domain of supporting the applications, they have the knowledge of what's being impacted from the business. And then the last piece is the big shift is about ingesting melt data, metrics, events, logs, and traces. So all valuable content to be able to figure out what's wrong with an application. But when you can see it on one single view, you know, the events that come in correlated amongst all the pieces. So if you're having a multi-failure, you're having a failure within the infrastructure, a failure within the services, you'll be able to see all the alerts that come in correlated to that issue. But then bringing in all the metrics. So you may have a large plethora of metrics that you're now monitoring, seen on one screen, but then also seeing traces, to be able to see the traces as you go through the application. And last bit is around the logs. So as you're going through troubleshooting an issue, the nice part is that you can see where the problem is. You see the failures, you see the multi-services that are starting to break apart or cause you issues. But then as you go into troubleshoot, you'd be able to quickly see that the problems isolated amongst, you know, these couple services, this infrastructure is causing the issue, but then give you the logging snippets that are tied to that issue at hand, so that when you're going through a troubleshooting process, you have all that valuable data right there to quickly find out what's wrong and resolve the problem. So when you kind of bring that all together, it sounds very complex, but we built it in a way that's actually very easy to deploy. It's integrating into the cloud providers, supporting OpenTelemetry, which is the open standard around cloud native observability. And then lastly, being able to just directly integrate to the infrastructure, namely around your Kubernetes deployment, and pull that down and correlate all that data. So that's one of the cool pieces that we just announced or just launched on June 28th that's really geared towards that complex cloud native architecture.
I'm sure my co-hosts will have plenty of questions there. They're chomping at the bit here behind the scenes. But before we get to them, we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's userway.org. Now, every website without exception needs to be accessible. Now, Userway's incredible AI-powered solution tirelessly enforces the hundreds of WCAG guidelines. In a matter of seconds, Userway AI can achieve more than what an entire team of developers can in months. Now, at first, it may seem overwhelming to make your website accessible, but Userway's solutions make it simple, easy, and cost effective. You can even use their free scanning tool to see if your website is ADA compliant. And if you have an enterprise level website with thousands of pages, Userway offers a managed solution where their team can handle everything for you. Userway's AI and machine learning solutions power accessibility for over a million websites trusted by Coca-Cola, Disney, eBay, FedEx, and many more leading brands. Now, Userway is making its best-in-class enterprise level accessibility tools available to small and medium-sized businesses. You can get started today for as little as $49 a month on Userway's monthly plan. Your company can be ADA compliant, reach more customers, and build loyalty. And remember, you get 30% off. There are 1 billion people in the world with disabilities. That's roughly 13% of the population that you don't want to lose as potential customers because you're not compliant. Think about it. By not being compliant, fines and revenue loss will cost you so much more. Userway is the leading accessibility solution in the market today with a market share of 61%, the biggest in the world. And for years, Userway has been on the cutting edge, creating an innovative accessibility technologies that push the envelope of what's possible with AI, machine learning, and computer vision. Userway's AI automatically fixes violations at the code level. And here are some of the things they can actually do. They can auto-generate image alts. It writes image descriptions for you, remediates complex nav menus, and ensures that all pop-ups are accessible, fixes vague link violations and any broken links, ensures your websites makes use of accessible colors while remaining true to your brand, and Userway gives your detailed report of all the violations that were fixed on your website. Userway is platform agnostic and it integrates seamlessly with things like Shopify, Wix, Sitecore, SharePoint, and many more out there. Now, let Userway help your business meet its compliance goals and improve the experience for your users. The voice of Siri, Susan Bennett, has a message about Userway.
Hi, I'm Susan Bennett, the original voice of Siri. You won't hear me say something like this too often. I'm sorry, I don't understand what you're looking for. But every day, that's what the internet is like for millions of people with disabilities. Userway fixes all of that with just one line of code.
Userway can make any website fully accessible and ADA compliant. With Userway, everyone who visits your site can browse seamlessly and customize it to fit their needs. It's also a perfect way to showcase your brand's commitment to millions of people with disabilities. Go to userway.org/twit and get 30% off UserWay's AI-powered accessibility solution. Book a short call and get their accessibility guide. UserWay, making the internet accessible for everyone. Visit userway.org/twit today. And we thank userway.org for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Greg Ostrowski. He's executive CTO at Cisco AppDynamics. We talked about observability, network device sprawl, and how to manage data that's coming from those devices. But I do want to bring my co-host back in because I got a bunch of questions here. Chibert, why don't you go first?
Actually, I want to talk about panes of glass. I've built several NOCs, and the number one complaint of every NOC denizen I've ever worked with is glass, you know, panes of glass sprawl across the NOC. I have bigger and bigger monitors or such. I have to apologize to Cisco Meraki, who is a sponsor of this show. I questioned some of their architecture when it first came out that I needed so much horsepower to be able to run their newfangled pane of glass, let's call it. And I started asking, why do you have so many hooks in there? What are you trying to do? And I'm starting to finally see, oh, because the panes of glass are starting to merge. How much conversations do you have across product lines at Cisco to help deal with this glass proliferation, let's call it?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting one. I'm going to answer two parts of that. One question you actually didn't even ask me, but I'm going to bring it up. Sure. So first off, I'm going to go back to what we've done with AppDynamics Cloud. And if you look at, if you take a look, so we have this available for trial today. And purchase for that matter. But the interesting thing about what we've seen industry-wide, I don't think this is a Cisco issue, what you're bringing up around panes of glass. I think this is something that's industry-wide. When we started looking at observability when it comes to cloud native, one of the things that we noticed is that a lot of the legacy tools that are out there are obviously running in their own domain. But as they start to merge to that cloud native strategy, what they just started to do is bolt on different capabilities to bring in additional data. Now, the one part that you guys will probably get, it'll just be tongue in cheek, but you'll probably get a kick out of this comment, but it's easy ingesting data. What you do with it's the difficult part. So that's the one that we really wanted to focus with. So when we built AppDynamics Cloud, we had built it so that different personas have the ability to use our tool using a single view. And if you look at the trend that's happening in the industry where organizations are either upskilling or hiring new folks to be, you know, cloud operations folks, infrastructure teams that are only focused on the cloud infrastructure, the developer teams that are working on cloud native applications. When we built AppDynamics Cloud, it was really geared so that you're not flipping back and forth between screens or tab to tab to be able to figure out what's going wrong. It's all about collaboration and bringing things together. The second part I want to bring up is when it comes to dashboards in particular, there is definitely some elements of dashboard fatigue that's in the industry. So, you know, you don't want to have a new dashboard for every product you roll out or new every initiative you have going. What really is folks want answers. They want to know what's happening. So one of but they want both, right? They want flexibility. Some folks want to be able to bridge between the two. So by including ways where we can just provide the results and the answers that they're looking for, like what's the impact to the business or the revenue or the components there, you know, as you kind of look at that as it brings forward the data that we found in the Agency Transformation Report, where a lot of IT professionals want to be are considering themselves business innovators or business leaders, you got to have that full view that includes the business. So from my point of view, when you kind of look at, you know, the overarching approach, I mean, we focus on, within AppDynamics, we focus on observability. So being able to see things and observe. Now, we've also done integrations with, in our full stack observability strategy, we've done integrations with AppDynamics and ThousandEyes, right? So ThousandEyes is a great tool to be able to provide visibility of the network, but not just the enterprise, visibility into the internet, right? As we become more and more dependent, you got to know if there's an ISP outage versus a enterprise network outage or ISP outage versus an application failure. The other component that we've integrated to was a product called Intersight. So now as you start to manage the elements of scale, right? That's one of the biggest challenges for any organization, when you see any kind of spiking element. By integrating AppDynamics into Intersight, we can feed our performance data into Intersight so that we can start to automate changes on behalf of the customer. So now examples would be you have an infrastructure powering your application. Maybe it could be VMs, it could be Kubernetes, could be containers. You want something that can automatically increase capacity in your infrastructure and then close it back down when this spiking event stops. So we've worked on that project to be able to integrate these three products together. And that's one of the strategies we're going to continue to grow upon, so that it's not a matter of just giving you panes of glass. It's a matter of giving you results, automation, and answers as you start to move down that path of building out a modernized strategy.
All right. Well, now we come to my chance to ask you some questions. And one of them is based on something that you said a few minutes ago. Sure. You mentioned everyone's favorite word when it comes to software supply chain: dependencies. Yeah. And so one of my questions is, are there limits on how many layers of dependencies you can look at? Because as we know, in many of the applications people are building, you can have, dependency on dependency on dependency. To quote a very old thing, it's turtles all the way down.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I guess that's one of those answers. I'll probably have a better answer for you in a couple of years when people really blow up when it comes to expanding out the dependencies they have. But I just want to bring up one. So let's start with microservices, right? So as you start to migrate to a microservices architecture, it's funny because I'll talk to customers and they'll say they have 300 applications that they want to modernize. So when you look at that, you're going to break that up into microservices as you take any one of those applications. So if you just do kind of simple math, if each application gets 10 microservices times 300, now you have 3,000, right? And that's very, very simple math, but it's actually very realistic. Now, what happens is that the dependencies are even more complex than just saying they're dependent, right? So when you run an application that's modernized, out of those 3,000, any 10, 15, 20 microservices may be called to act together, perform a function, and then close back down, right? So that's one level of dependencies. So one of the things that we had put in our product is that you got to be able to take that map of all your microservices and quickly distill it down based on what you want to look at. So in the event of, you have your overall topology, and I always kind of make the joke that, the microservice topology map is going to be like laying out on a hot summer night looking up at the stars, because you're going to have so many of them. You're going to have a few that are going to be called. Now, the value here is that it's not a matter of the dependencies that are sitting there as they're in their idle state. It's when they're called. So when you can start to visualize, if you have a retail application or an e-commerce application that gets called, you want to be able to see all the dependencies for that particular application, because everything is running disparate, right? Now, when you kind of bring that together, it's about quickly being able to understand what your dependencies are. So that's your microservices. Then as you start getting under the application, you have the dependencies of the containers or the Kubernetes environment. So when you kind of think about that, as each person comes in, they're going to get a new container, and you're going to scale and scale and scale and scale and close back down. So the essence there is that, how do you provide observability of something that's only there for a point in time? And that's what one of the pieces that, we really wanted to focus on strongly, so that those infrastructure teams and those application development teams can have that clear understanding of what is it that I'm working on and how is it impacting other folks in the overarching stream of the application? So it's a really, really interesting question you asked, but I think there's a lot to it that can be uncovered as you start to understand what your dependencies are with any given application.
Well, again, you open the door for another question, and that is, as we see companies begin to actually deploy on containers rather than simply using them as a dev tool, what is that doing to the level of complexity in trying to keep everything visible? Does it enhance observability when things move to containers? Does it complicate things? What's the impact?
So realistically, it complicates observability to some extent, because and I'm going to kind of give you a little bit of a hierarchy here. At the very first layer, the challenge is that when you move to that dynamic world, the amount of volume of data that you now need to ingest to be able to provide the proper levels of observability grows exponentially. At a minimum, might be 10x, 100x, it's going to continuously grow. So right there is a challenge of not just observability, but it's a challenge of scale, right? So when you kind of think about it from that point of view, you know, we're in our early stages now, and many customers that are rolling out a containerized environment, if you start looking at your benchmarks of where you want to roll out over the next couple of years, you're going to see a tremendous amount of growth. And that's growth around the number of containers that you're going to have. Hopefully that's a good thing, because it means you got more customers using your applications. But the gist of it is the data volume is going to be tremendously large in size. So when you kind of look at that from a, how do you observe that? That's the other reason why we had built a platform from the ground up that's able to scale and handle that magnitude. Because that's one of those things that I think is going to become more and more difficult as the future starts to move through and we start to grow and you become more of an elastic environment that is getting larger in size. I mean, most of the customers I had spoken to that are not 100% cloud native, if they're in the process of transitioning, the change from going from point A to point B is not a matter of, you know, flipping a switch. There's a fair amount of work and effort that goes into it. So as you're going through that process and moving through a containerized strategy, it's always good to always take a regular check of understanding how large your environment is actually going to grow to and scale to, so that you know, you understand that as a business that's running that, but then the observability piece has to be right in it from the get-go, so that you can see that full stack view from an overarching approach.
We have lots more to talk about here, but unfortunately all good things come to an end. We'll have to do it next time. Greg, thank you so much for being here.
Since we're
running a little bit low on time, can you maybe tell the folks at home where they can learn more about Cisco AppDynamics, the new cloud native stuff that you guys are doing, and maybe how organizations can get started?
Well, the first way to learn about it is watching This Week in Enterprise. So always watch every episode. But the best place to go find about AppDynamics and AppDynamics Cloud is appdynamics.com. And you can find out everything that I talked about. You can find our Agents of Transformation report, see if you fit in that same category with other professionals, but also the new exciting release of AppDynamics Cloud that we just launched about 3 weeks ago. So thanks again for having me on the show. It's always fun.
Thanks again, Greg.
I love how we're plugging each other.
Yeah, that's right. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise and IT news podcast in the universe. So definitely tune your podcatcher to Twyatt. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my near and dear friends and co-hosts. Starting at the very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, thanks for being here. What's going on for you the coming weeks? Where can people find you and where can people find your work?
Well, they won't be able to find me in one physical location because I'm going to be doing a lot of travel. So the best thing to do is follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA. I'll be posting there, looking at lots of stuff. You can also follow me over on LinkedIn, where I do articles as well as some videos. Always love to do that and love to hear from members of the Twyatt Riot. One thing I will say, I've mentioned the Omdia Analyst Summit coming up at Black Hat the week following that. There is an all-day online event sponsored by Information Week where I'm going to be delivering a keynote speech. Go over to informationweek.com. You should be able to find a link to sign up for that. That's a free event. We'd love to see you there as well.
Thank you, Curtis. Looking forward to all that stuff. Well, folks, we also have to thank our very own Mr. Brian Chiebert. What's going up, coming up for you in the coming weeks, and where can people get a hold of you, maybe talk about the show?
Well, I like answering Twitter. You know, Twitter's a great platform. I am ADVNETLAB. That's Advanced Net Lab. That is actually a leftover from when I was still at the University of Hawaii doing testing. Someday, I think I'm going to need to roll that over to my students at Leeward Community College. Looks like my Class C IPv4 subnet's finally going to move to them so they can teach again with it, which will be a lot of fun. If you'd like, you're also welcome to throw email at me. I'm Chiebert, spelled Cheebert, at twit.tv. Or you're welcome to also throw email at twit at twit.tv, and you'll hit all the hosts. Looking forward to your show ideas, and look forward to chatting with you.
Thanks, Chiebert. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person that comes in each and every week to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your enterprise and IT news. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/twiet. There we go. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, co-host information, guest information, of course, and all the links that we do during the show. But more importantly, right over there during those next to those videos, video links you get there, you get those helpful subscribe and download links. Support the show by getting your audio version or your video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your devices, on any one of your podcast applications, because we're on all of them. So definitely subscribe and support the show. Plus, you may have also heard, we also have Club Twit as well. That's right. It's a members-only ad-free podcast service with a bonus Twit Plus feed. You can't get anywhere else, and it's only $7 a month. That's right. There are a lot of great things about Club Twit. One of them is the exclusive access to the members-only Discord server. I love it. I'm on there right now. Chat with hosts, producers, separate discussion channels. There's also special events, so definitely check that out. Lots of fun stuff going on there. So definitely join Club Twit and be part of the movement. Go to twit.tv/ClubTwit. Club Twit also offers corporate group plans as well. It's a great way to give your team access to our ad-free tech podcast. The plans start with 5 members at a discounted rate of $6 each per month, and you can add as many seats as you like. And really great way to have your IT departments, your service departments, developers, your tech team stay on top of all of our podcasts. And of course, just like regular memberships out there, they can join the Twit Discord server and get that Twit Plus bonus feed as well. So definitely join Club Twit. Be part of the fun, be part of the movement. twit.tv/ClubTwit. Now, after you're subscribed, impress your friends, your family members, your coworkers with giving them the gift of Twiet, because we talk about a lot of fun stuff on this show. We want to share it with them as well. We guarantee they'll find it interesting as well. So definitely share it with them. And of course, if you're gonna be around, you know, if you've already subscribed, if you're gonna be around on 1:30 p.m. Pacific on Fridays right now, we do this show live. That's right. Come see how the pizza's made, the behind the scenes. Go to live.twit.tv. There we have all the streams you can choose from. You can watch this show as it's happening and see all the fun stuff. But of course, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well go ahead and jump into the amazing chat room as well. We have our IRC chat room out there right now. Lots of great characters in there each and every week. We have lots of great discussions. They give us topics for the show, questions, lots of stuff going on there. So definitely jump in there and be part of the IRC channel, irc.twit.tv. Definitely hit me up, twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all my enterprise tidbits, of course. Direct message me with show ideas, things you want to have on the show, any tech topics, questions, that kind of thing. Definitely hit me up there. I have lots of great conversations each and every week. Of course, hit me up on LinkedIn as well. There I have topics around, whether we want different topics for the show, of course, where to find things, how I can help you with some of the things on developing Office integration. So definitely hit me up there if you have any questions. Of course, if you want to know what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft, go to developers.microsoft.com/office. There we are right there. There you can find all the latest and greatest ways to customize your office experience to make it more productive for you. You can use web technologies, use modern web technologies like TypeScript and JavaScript. You can use the more legacy ways of doing things as well. We support all the gamut of customizing Office, so definitely check it out and make it more productive for you and your organization. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support this Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we couldn't do the show without them. So thank you for all their support. They're enjoying a cruise this week, so hopefully the Twit cruise is going well with Mr. Paul Thurrott over there. I also want to thank everyone at Twit, of course, the staff and the engineers as well. I also want to thank Mr. Brian Shi one more time, because he's not only our co-host, our beloved co-host, but he's also our beloved tireless producer as well. He does all the show bookings and all the plannings for the show, and we really couldn't do the show without him. So thank you, Chibert, for all your help and all your support over the years. Now, before we sign out, we also have to thank our editor for today, Mr. Anthony. He makes us look good after the fact. And of course, we also have to thank our talented TD as well. He's Mr. Ant Pruitt, and he does an amazing show called Hands-On Photography. I learn a ton of tricks from you every week. Can you maybe tell the show folks at home what's going on Hands-On Photography this week?
Well, thank you, Mr. Liu. Let me go ahead and tell you. This week's show, we're just going to talk about how all of us photographers think we're just so perfect. But yet, I'm going to prove you wrong to let you know, nope, you are not a perfect photographer. You're going to screw some stuff up. And I had a little fun with it, and I encourage everyone to go check it out, twit.tv/hop, and send in some of your responses regarding that episode.
Thanks, Ant. I can definitely tell you I do not think that I take great photos. I definitely make mistakes, but I'll still check that out because I need to learn some tricks. So thank you, Ant. And until next time, I'm Louis Moresco, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Is that an iPhone in your hand? Wait a second, is that an Apple Watch on your wrist? And do I see an iPad sitting there on the table? Oh my goodness, you are the perfect person to be watching iOS Today, the show where Rosemary Orchard and I, Micah Sargent, talk all things iOS, tvOS, watchOS, HomePodOS. It's all the OSs that Apple has on offer, and we show you how to make the most of those gadgets. Just head to twit.tv/iOS to check it out.